Good morning, brethren. Good to be with you. Go ahead and turn in your Old Testaments, if you have a Bible at the ready, to Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. And as you're turning there, I want to read a very different context for you to think about from Exodus 20, 3 through 6. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. What I just read from was part of the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20. You may have heard that in the language. Those words, I have no doubt, lived in the heart of Daniel and lived in the heart of Daniel's friends as they tried to navigate the difficulties of serving God in a land that was chock full of idolatry. In chapter 1, you remember they were able to quietly maneuver around the king's commands, and without Nebuchadnezzar's knowledge at all, they were able to eat in ways that honored God and not the gods of Babylon or Nebuchadnezzar. But here in Daniel chapter 3, Daniel's friends are going to be confronted with a situation that they cannot quietly maneuver around, because sometimes that is not possible to do. Sometimes when you're living as an exile, attention is drawn in a very specific kind of way to the differences between how you live and the God that you serve and the gods that everybody else serves around you. That happens here. And so when those moments come for us, as inevitably they will in different kinds of ways, may we face our Nebuchadnezzars and our golden images with the same kind of faith that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did in Daniel chapter 3, so that we can honor the God of deliverance, and so that we can hopefully cause pagans in the nation around us to serve that God as well. Look with me here in Daniel chapter 3. Let's start reading together in 1 through 7. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." I want you to notice some interesting things right off the bat as we get into this chapter. The fact that there is a statue in this story is probably not very surprising if you have tracked with us so far in the book of Daniel, because in chapter 2, we had a statue as well, but that statue was not sitting in a physical spot. That statue was in the mind of King Nebuchadnezzar as he lay in his bed at night. And that statue was made of metal, but that statue was made of lots of different kinds of metals to represent all of the nations that were Babylon, the head of gold, and that would come after Babylon, after his days were numbered, and Babylon was given over to the dominion of some other nation. And so I think it's rather interesting. Here we got another statue, and the whole thing is gold, not just the head, which in chapter 2 represented King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. Remember that? And I don't know exactly what's in Nebuchadnezzar's mind as he orders this monstrosity to be made and set up in a plain, a flat land where it can be seen and honored and worshipped all the way around, maybe for miles around. Is this Nebuchadnezzar's way of pushing back against God's view of history? Is this way his way of saying, I don't just want to be the head, I want to be the whole thing? Was this an image of a Babylonian god, or was this an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself? We're not given those details, but regardless, it's an idol. And your allegiance to the king is tied up with your worship of this image. You got to do that because you got to honor me, is the point of what he's doing here. You remember how Nebuchadnezzar was told in the last chapter by God, through Daniel's voice, that all dominion and rulership has been given to you. You rule over all the people around you and over all the beasts and all over everything. But Nebuchadnezzar still seems to have a great bit of insecurity in his heart. And so he, perhaps because God told him he wouldn't always live forever. Remember, that's what people always say to these kings as they come into their presence. Oh, king, live forever. God says, yeah, you're not going to live forever, dude. And there's going to be the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and so on and so forth. Maybe this is what compels him to feel the need to require a show of loyalty. But regardless, this is what he does and this is what he builds. And it's interesting, we're told the dimensions of this idol. This is a really odd sort of gold-plated thing, because you notice in verse 1, it is 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. If you translate that into feet, this is 90 feet tall, and it's really, really skinny. It's 9 feet wide compared to how tall it is. If you compare that to other things, that's the height of about a 10-story building, all right? If you compare this to the Colossus of Rhodes, one of the ancient wonders of the world that stood for a little while, that was about 105 feet tall. If you look at the Statue of Liberty without her pedestal, that's about 151 feet tall. So this thing is massive. At least it's very tall. And so this was the choice that all the peoples, nations, and languages, all the officials of Babylon are confronted with on this plain of Dura. And although we are not faced with the same sort of decision, obviously, here in 21st century America, we don't have a King Nebuchadnezzar staring us down. We don't have a massive golden idol that everybody in Rantoul is ordered to go and worship. Thankfully, that would be very weird in our culture. But we are tempted to seek deliverance from things that we turn into idols, do we not, sometimes? We don't look for deliverance from Nebuchadnezzar, but we might look for deliverance from sickness or weakness of some kind, addictions, loneliness, unhappiness, futility, a bad relationship, a bad boss, a dissatisfying job, injustice, you name it. And this can even manifest itself in trivial kinds of ways. We're in this nation of opulence. We are encouraged to dive into various hobbies and pleasures that we have the time and the wealth to acquire, right? I do. I'm sure you probably do too. I love drinking coffee and I love reading books. among other things. But what if I come to a day where my doctor looks at me from across the room and says, you know, you really need to lay off the coffee, you know, stick to tea or water or something else. What if I come to a day where my eyesight miserably fails and I can't read books like I used to do and like I used to enjoy doing? If that is devastating to me in some kind of real way, then I think an idol of my heart has just been revealed. We're encouraged in our culture to take care of our bodies and maintain and preserve our youth. We got to pay attention to the vitamins and the medical technology and the exercise and the right diet. But when my body declines in a way that is outside of my control, if that is devastating to me and it prevents me from going forward in serving the kingdom of God and focusing on Him and His people and His ways, then an idol of my heart has just been revealed. If we're lonely, we might try to satisfy that with relationships, spouse, children, best friends, you name it. But what if something happens to your spouse or your children or your friends, just like what happened to Job? Or what if your spouse or your children or your friends evolve and change in ways that you did not expect? If that is devastating to you or to me, and we can't move forward, then an idol of our heart has just been revealed. Here's the bottom line. If I lose my joy in God, in His kingdom, and in what He has given to me to do, because something that I value has been diminished or even removed from my life, then that has shown me where I am bowing down to a golden image. And so in that situation, I probably don't need a pill for depression. I probably need to repent of my idolatry and return to my God. And that might sound overly simplistic, so let me just say a little bit more about that. Yes, there may be appropriate times to mess with brain chemicals. And I have a close family member who, in that kind of situation, he has received some benefit from medical pills. But if you are deeply unhappy with your life, that is not going to be solved by drugs that merely address the physical mind. What's probably going on deeper than that is a spiritual issue of the heart that the Lord needs to help you with. We need to make sure that we do not mask our idols, but that we rip them all out by the roots. When we're done with this sermon, Brent is going to sing and lead us in "The Lily of the Valley." You know what a line of that is? I have all for Him forsaken and all my idols torn from my heart, and now He keeps me by His power. When we sing that in a little bit, can we sing that with honesty or deception? I want you to notice something else about these first seven verses. It's kind of interesting. Did you notice the repetitious language that's happening here? I think what that's doing is that's creating a scenario in which disobedience was unthinkable. Six different times we're told that the Babylonian king set up this image. Two different times, we're given a very extensive list of all the different kinds of people who went to this plain and worshiped this idol. Two different times, we're given this big, long list of all the various instruments in this orchestra that played in the idol worship. That's verses 5 and 7. And verses 4 and 7, two different times, we're told about all the peoples, nations, and languages that were there that obeyed the command. All of these phrases pile up and just kind of create this inevitable sense of momentum. It's like this huge snowball that's just rolling down the hill, and it can't be conceived of to get in the way of that thing.
I mean, you got to just let it roll. For verse 7, from the king's vantage point, everybody is here and everybody is doing this, what he wants them to do. I mean, verse 7 reads, as soon as all the peoples heard all those different instruments, everybody bowed down to the image. The orchestra plays its music, the sea of bodies prostrate themselves, and the ceremony is over, just like that. Or is it? Because wait a minute, from chapter 1 and chapter 2, especially, I mean, right at the end of chapter 2, we're told that Daniel and Daniel's friends are appointed in high official positions in the Empire of Babylon. Were they there? What did they do about this statue? We don't have to wait too long to find out. Let's keep reading together. Verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. The story takes a very interesting turn. We're wondering about the officials of who were Jewish, who were probably there. They were there, at least Daniel doesn't seem to be. But notice what happens here. The sorcerers who are standing by these Jewish men, they notice that they are not among all the peoples, nations, and languages that bow. And so these men come to the king. Notice the phrase there, the Chaldeans, certain of the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? Well, sometimes that word is used to just talk about Babylonians, but here in Daniel, Chaldeans is a way to talk about the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the very same guys who couldn't do anything back in chapter 1 with Nebuchadnezzar's dream when he brings them in and says, okay, you got to tell me what this is talking about. Remember how because Daniel revealed the dream and the interpretation, God revealed that to Daniel, Daniel was able to save all those guys. No, keep them from destruction. I can help the king. Well, instead of being grateful about that, some of these Chaldeans are filled with jealousy and now try to get rid of these Jews who are climbing up the ladder ahead of him. And so they know how to push the buttons of Nebuchadnezzar. They're not listening to you. They don't worship your gods, the image that you have set up. I think it's interesting, verse 8, the original Aramaic behind that word accused, you notice there it says that they accused the Jews. The original Aramaic literally means they ate the pieces of the Jews. This is not, well, we love these men, but we feel bound in our conscience because we love you, O King, to turn them in, but we really don't want to. This is, we'd love to see them fall as fast and as hard as they possibly can. Does it sound familiar? This idea of righteous Jews being delivered up to an enemy out of jealousy? Isn't this exactly what happened to Jesus Christ? Except in that instance, it was fellow Jews who were turning Jesus into the Roman authorities who didn't have a clue about what was going on and didn't really care until they were forced to make a decision about it. But even Pilate, Matthew 27 says, even Pilate could tell it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. But Jesus was not defeated by the jealousy of his enemies, and neither will that be the case here. But these men do try to destroy them. But the king takes up that bait, and he calls those guys in, and he says, okay, is this true? King Nebuchadnezzar wants every knee to bow and every tongue to confess his authority and lordship over all these different people. He's not content with 98% obedience from the crowd. His anger flares when he's told about the disobedience at first, but he holds it back. I mean, after all, these guys are foreigners. You know, maybe they didn't quite understand what the command was, or maybe they understood it, but they've got some qualms about worshiping my God or me, this image that I've set up. So I tell you what, we'll give you another shot. I'll have the orchestra unpack all the instruments again. We'll play it again, and that will be your opportunity to obey now, right? Right? Verse 15, though, Nebuchadnezzar lays bare the spiritual condition of his heart when he says, and if you don't obey me, who is going to help you? Not just fellow humans can't help you, the gods can't help you. Who's going to deliver you out of my hands? I don't think Nebuchadnezzar had ever read the book of Deuteronomy before. But I'm very confident that these three friends had. And there's a passage in Deuteronomy 32 in which God says, see now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God besides me. I kill and make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hands. You see, there is only one God. There's only one person. There's one being who has the right to talk like that, and it is not Nebuchadnezzar. It is God Most High. And so the orchestra prepares to play, but before the music even starts, these three friends speak, and there's no hemming and hawing. There's no, we'll think about it. Can we have an hour? Can we come back to this another day? They have known ever since they were called to this plane to worship this idol that this very moment was probably in the works for them, that this choice was before them to make. And so they immediately lay all their cards on the table, and they say, there is no possible way that we can do this. We have confidence in the God that we serve. You don't seem to have that, but we certainly do. But regardless of whether we survive this day or not, we're not serving your gods. We're not bound down to this image. Or to put it another way, in words that were used much, much later, we must obey God rather than man. I get the feeling that the king of Babylon was not used to having people talk to him in this kind of way. because of what the text says his reaction was. Have you ever been talking to somebody and you can see that they've got a placid smile on their face in one moment and they have an angry scowl on their face a couple of moments later based on how the conversation goes? I get the mental picture of that going on in verse 19, that the expression of his face was changed. You know, he becomes the king who has all authority and is very confident that everybody's going to just kowtow to his desires, to now very unsure about whether these guys are going to obey or not, and very angry about that. And so he orders the furnace to match the heat and intensity of his own anger. And maybe this is even the furnace, because this furnace, it seems to be right next to this idol. Maybe this is even the furnace that was used to construct the idol in the first place. I don't know that for sure, but regardless, it's right there at the ready. And so these three Jews, they serve a God who called himself a consuming fire in Deuteronomy 4, and now they are thrown into a consuming fire because of their allegiance to this God. But they're not going to be consumed. Although, you notice that the Babylonian soldiers are. Because this is such an urgent moment, and because this fire is so hot, they bind up these guys in all of these interesting details, cloaks, tunics, hats, other garments. Why we're given those details, we'll find out soon. But they bind them up, and they throw them in, and they die. There's something a little ironic about this, because I think those soldiers were probably among the crowd who was bowing down to this image just a few moments before this. And yet that image didn't save these soldiers. The gods didn't save these soldiers. Nebuchadnezzar didn't save these soldiers who served him. And he really doesn't seem to care about what happened, because the text just moves right along. Oh, my. Well, these guys are a dime a dozen. But the story is different for the men who are cast into the fire. Let's keep reading. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 24, was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? And they answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed. Their cloaks were not harmed, and nor smell of fire had come upon them. Then Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. We're not told how many people could see inside the furnace and could tell exactly what was going on there, but King Nebuchadnezzar obviously can. And so he looks in and he is amazed, because, and he looks out at his guys and he says, okay, quick head counts. How many people did we throw in there? It was, you know, Shadrach, Meshach. It was three, right? Yeah, it was three. But he sees these guys walking around in the flames instead of seeing charred bodies huddled up on the floor of the furnace. They're now up and walking, and there's somebody else in there with them, and that somebody else does not look like a normal Joe, not like the usual chaps that we throw into the fire these days. God could have saved these guys in any way that he chose to, but he intentionally gave his assistance in this kind of way so Nebuchadnezzar could visibly see that that they're getting help from the gods, from the God Most High specifically. So this prideful king could be humbled by that. And I think it's interesting that at the beginning of this chapter, all the officials are compelled to come to the plain of Dura to worship this idol. But in verse 27, nobody compels these guys to come to the furnace, but they all flock to see the actions of the true God. And what they see amazes them. These men were told back when it says that they were bound up, they're wearing all kinds of flammable materials, hats, tunics, clothes of different various kinds, but nothing is burnt. Nothing is even singed. In fact, they don't even smell like they've been in a fire. You know, usually when there's something that's burnt, I can smell it on the complete other end of the house. When anything is cooked, whether it's burnt or not, you can smell it. I remember we were having Brent and Kendra over a couple of weeks ago, and Brent was saying, yeah, I could even smell whatever it was Jenny was cooking on the street before we even got to your front door. If something had happened in that furnace, it would be pretty obvious to everybody what was going on there. But everything is fine. That is absolutely miraculous. These men were not saved from being thrown into the fire because God expected to save them from the consequences, the natural consequences of the fire. And that was all the more remarkable to the people who were around this furnace. God's servants were rescued, but even more than that, God was glorified. That is the true point of this story. The primary purpose of this miracle was to impress the pagan king. Because again, remember, Nebuchadnezzar seems to be the only one who is looking in and getting a sense of what is going on. The king now understands that Yahweh is more than just a revealer of mysteries. He's not just a God who can tell you what your dreams mean, although he certainly can do that and even give you the dream to begin with. He's a God who can save. He's a God who rescues. And that will also be demonstrated with Daniel in chapter 6. Remember back in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar challenged all the gods, even his own gods, to rescue these men that he thought he had full control over. But now, 13 verses later, he is now blessing the God of heaven, God Most High, as he calls him, who delivers his servants who trusted in him. And he issues this decree, and this decree is so like Nebuchadnezzar. You know, you're either going to do this or you're going to be ripped to shreds. There's really no middle ground here. He issues this decree. He promotes the three friends that he once tried to destroy. But again, the point of this story is to think about the glorification of the God that we serve. As Christians, looking back at this ancient story, it is the same God who has the power to deliver his servants today. I want to return as we close to this scripture in Isaiah 43 that Brother Danny read for us a while back, and really especially focus on verses 2 and 3. You ever seen this? Have you ever connected it to Daniel 3 before? When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And by you, he's talking about the nation of his people as a whole. And through the rivers, and they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. Now, because the text is silent about this, I don't know, beyond what the three friends say to Nebuchadnezzar, I don't know what was coursing through their minds as they stood there with all of Babylon looking at them. But I have to wonder if this wasn't maybe one of the scriptures that they were thinking about at that time. Because what God is saying here is, I'm going to rescue you. Now, obviously, God doesn't guarantee all of his people protection from every difficult moment that they face, at least physical protection. Sometimes, for the glory of God's name, it is best for his servants to suffer in the moment. And the three friends acknowledge that. It could be God can deliver us, but it could be that he chooses to let us be burned up to a crisp, because that fits the glory of his plan. And if that is the case, so be it. But we read this passage and we see the fulfillment in a physical way in Daniel 3. But even more than that, we see the fulfillment for us in that God saves us from the eternal fires of hell. That we were children of wrath, like Paul says in Ephesians, destined for fire, away from the presence of the Lord. But because of what Jesus did on the cross, we are now blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. We are no longer children of wrath. We are adopted sons and daughters of the King. This King, the Holy One of Israel, who rescues you from water and fire and everything else. And so if we praise him, come what may, we have an opportunity to glorify him in the presence of others too. So that hopefully others will have the same kind of reaction as Nebuchadnezzar does at the end of this chapter. Verse 28, blessed be this God who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. Do you and I trust in this God the way that we should, the way that these men did? Or are we secretly, in some sort of way, bowing down to our own form of the golden image that we set up? Appreciate your attention to the words of God. We're going to sing a song now that gives you the opportunity to come forward and declare to us, but even more than us, Jesus Christ, that you would like to serve him, that you'd like to sign up for his cause, that you'd like to return to him, that you would like to be more faithful than you have before. If we can help you in any way in your walk with this God, please let us know as we stand up and sing the invitation song.